Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order, February 17th, 2021. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Bishop, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, and myself, Stedman. We have one item on the agenda today. We're going to hear from the Alaska Municipal League. It's going to give us an update on the municipalities around the state. So I'd like to go ahead and invite the Alaska Municipal League Executive Director forward into the hot seat, if he could come sit in the middle seat. Introduce himself for the record. He's got a presentation that we have put on a Slim Fast diet, and it still looks pretty hefty, so we're going to try to get through this today. I think the meeting gets done 15 minutes early. Is that correct, Skill?
Yeah.
So I'll watch the clock, and if we start going too slow, we'll try to pick up the pace. I'd like to get this finished today. Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through the presentation, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nils Andreasen. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. And I want to extend my appreciation to the committee for allowing us to make this presentation. I'll admit that it's comprehensive, or as comprehensive as I could get it, and want to give you as much of the big picture when it comes to local governments, their interaction with the state, and how state budget decisions impact municipalities. I will also be the first to admit that we're not OMB and we're not Ledge Finance, so if there are numbers that need correcting, I'm happy to work with your staff to do so after this presentation. The big picture when it comes to the state budget and municipal implications are that municipalities are pretty strong contributors to the state's economy. They experience cuts and cost shifting when the state reduces its budget. For example, 2 years ago when the FY20 budget was first proposed, it included almost $1 billion in cuts that fell on just 20 local governments. And when it comes to state budget reductions, those are pretty significant at the local level. Beyond the direct impacts of state budget reductions or cost shifting, there are indirect costs. And, you know, things like public radio and TV, the ferry system, all impact communities in a different way than things like reductions to community assistance do. I think it's important too for the committee to know that while reductions that impact local governments, direct reductions, don't reduce the overall state government, they do eliminate the state's support for partners. And these partners are at the local level, delivering things like public safety, education, and other elements that are important to our communities. And the response that local governments have when faced with budget reductions are to look at increased or new taxes, to reduce their own provision of services, to reduce capital investments and maintenance, and to eliminate programs and staff. The basics, and I know that for those folks around this table, you're familiar with a lot of this. There are 165 cities and boroughs in the state. That's out of 224 or so communities. So 165 of those 224 are incorporated as political subdivisions of the state. That includes 19 boroughs, 145 cities, and then one organized city that's organized under federal law. Throughout this pandemic, we've heard a lot of talk about this distinction between home rule and general law municipalities, and I thought I would highlight it here. Home rule governments, the minority of those 155, may do anything not prohibited by law. And I underline may because it doesn't require necessarily that they do things all things not prohibited by law, but they're allowed to take on multiple powers as they choose. General law municipalities, the majority of local governments may only do those things that are allowed by law. And there are very few musts that local governments have to do. And when it comes to boroughs, and then extending out to home rule and first class cities in the unorganized borough, those musts are education, planning and platting, and taxation. Local governments in Alaska serve 825,000 Alaskans. I realize that's greater than the population, but I note that there are overlapping jurisdictions between boroughs and cities, and while they provide different services, the actual number of people that Alaska's local governments are serving are greater than the state's population in some respects. Local governments are a significant employer. Local governments employ directly 7,700 Alaskans, and when you combine local governments with schools, as Department of Labor does, you get to more like 20,000 Alaskan residents who are employees of local governments. And when it comes to their budgets, revenues and expenditures, I'll go into this on the next slides, but here's a quick snapshot from FY18 to FY19. You can see local government tax revenue stayed right around $1.86 billion. Their total revenues in FY19 and FY20 that we have numbers for, just over $2.5 billion. So the difference between those two numbers is, one is just tax revenue, and the total revenue then would include federal and state transfers, including things like community assistance or PILT. And I'll talk more about the payment in lieu of taxes and other revenues here in a minute. Their revenues, their expenses tracked revenues, so just over around $2.5 billion. And in FY20, where there were greater expenditures than revenues, local governments would have drawn down from their fund balance or emergency reserves.
Okay, before you go on to that slide, Senator Von Imhoff, you have a question?
I no longer do, no. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
I wanted to know just how different communities are, and I mentioned this may and must, and some communities are required to do some things and some are not. Local governments are impacted by state budget decisions very differently, and differently in terms of the total number of communities who may experience an impact. And here's just a quick demonstration of what that looks like. Here are four different areas that are important to local governments and to the state. So out of 165 cities and boroughs in Alaska, only 64 are PERS employers. Out of 165 cities and boroughs, those who make a school contribution are only, I think, 34 enlisted there. And those numbers are very different than those communities who are impacted by and benefit from the Power Cost Equalization Program, where you have more than just over 100 local governments and communities who experience the benefits from that that equalization. And the fourth kind of variation that I would point to is when it comes to public safety. 70 local governments have police powers out of 165. So not every local government experiences state decision making the same. And when it comes to state decision making, there's a lot of variability even within each of those groups about what kinds of impacts there might be. So on this next slide, slide five, I stole this from Department of Revenue. They presented this a couple weeks back to this body. And I added in blue kind of where local governments fit into this picture. So when it comes to what pays for state government, Department of Revenue talked about $8.7 billion in state revenue. I pulled out just the $1.8 billion in local government tax revenue, which puts local governments just above petroleum and below investment earnings in terms of the total number that funds state programs. And I consider local governments in their provision of state services as being kind of part of this bigger picture. And so this is one way to think about the value that local governments bring. Local government revenues, again, just over around $2.5 billion. Property tax is most significant of this. This is 15 of 19 boroughs, 21 cities, just under $1.5 billion in property tax collected. I mentioned the state property tax, and it is true that the state requires of boroughs and home rule first class cities a property tax or equivalent as their contribution to education. So this is the 2.65 mils that the state mandates of these local governments, and the equivalency is 256 million in terms of their contribution. Sales taxes, just over 100 municipalities with a sales tax, revenues of 260 million. And then additional taxes and fees, tobacco, fish, car rentals, bed, alcohol taxes, $146 million. So that's where local government revenues come from and directly tied to economic activity within their jurisdictions. And then the rest of local government budgets come from, again, state and federal transfers. So that's federal payment in lieu of taxes, or PILT, and then secure rural schools, things like community assistance and grants. And I'll just mention that this total revenue is less the state's mandatory exemptions, and specifically the senior citizens and disabled veteran property tax exemption, which this last year was just under $100 million that was mandatorily exempted by the state.
Are you done with this slide? Thanks, Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So Mr. Andreasen, I just have a question about the sales tax. Was there a change where e-commerce, folks who buy stuff online with Amazon and Walmart and so forth, can the local sales tax, I believe now, is being charged and paid to the local communities at this time, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes. And so with the Wayfair decision passed by the Supreme Court, almost all states now that have sales tax have passed online sales tax or remote seller sales tax collection laws, and Alaska's local governments have that same ability. And we've implemented basically a commission to act as a Department of Revenue might otherwise in working with local governments to collect that sales tax on remote sales. The value of that is approximately, one way to estimate it is about 5%. Right now, physical sales tax collection is about what's collected in remote sales tax collection.
So, follow up. So just to confer, so if you have $260 million in the total taxes, you'd say, you know, $13 million is, you know, or $1.3 million, I guess, is probably, is that 5% of that? Is that what you're collecting, you would say, in e-commerce?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that's about right. So out of 104, 106 local governments with a sales tax, mm-hmm. only 34 are participating in the program right now, so they have to sign on and adopt a uniform code. So it's not capturing the total, but it's capturing the by far the largest local sales tax collectors in the state. And so it's for this fiscal year, it'll be just under $10 million that's collected.
Okay, thank you.
Remote sales tax.
Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you. Is there a way to know how much of that sales, online sales tax may be over-collected for municipal municipalities that people are being taxed just because of their zip codes that don't actually live within those city limits? Like all of Wasilla is about 99654, but only of that 26 square miles, only half of that belongs in the city. And those tax exemptions are pretty hard to get. So I just didn't know if AML actually has a breakout of folks that are actually being taxed outside of living within those tax boundaries.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Wilson. Tax outside the boundaries would be against the law. And so for those jurisdictions that join the Remote Sales Tax Commission, the sales tax boundaries are GIS coded, and we have paid for a company to map all that out. For all the sellers to use, and they should be using that if they're not, and if they're applying a zip code instead, then the buyer would be eligible for a reimbursement or a refund on the sales tax collected, and that should be taken up with the seller.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. Next slide.
Just to juxtapose revenues with expenditures, again, local governments are have balanced budgets, and their expenditures were $2.5 billion dollars. They contribute $130 million into PERS, or 5% of their total expenditures. They're also carrying $4.2 billion in bond debt as they actively contribute to public infrastructure in their communities. They contribute a total of $486 million as part of their local education contribution. It's 20% of their total expenses. It is 25% roughly of the state's overall obligation to public education. And so it's $230 million more than their required local contribution. The other, there's four kind of main buckets that local government expenditures fall into. So it's education, it's public safety, and it's worth noting that there are 40 local governments with a combined budget of $75 million more than the Department of Public Safety. It's quality of life, things that keep small communities whole, keep families and students and businesses happy and want to live in Alaska communities. And the fourth is public facilities, so water, sewer, landfills, roads, and harbors, and the majority of ports and harbors in the state. All the charts that I've done are inflation adjusted, and again, I'm happy to work on the math or the numbers if we haven't done it right, but I just wanted to show that municipal expenditures have actually tracked down over time, at least since FY13, as far back as I was able to go. And so we are, I mean, you can see local governments adjusting to this new fiscal reality.
Anyone continue?
When it comes to state decision making, one of the greatest impact is through vetoes. Vetoes from within a state budget give local governments very little time to adjust, and many local governments adopt their budgets at around the same time the state does, depending on how that lines up. We did an analysis of all the vetoes that were made within the FY20 and FY21 budgets. So this is the total, it's not the total number that were enacted. And the legislature really did some great work to adjust and respond to many of the vetoes that occurred during this time. But it was interesting to see how vetoes fell. And really they fall into three or four buckets that do directly impact local governments. So one, vetoes fell on health and social services, including public health programs, behavior and mental health. They fell on local governments and schools, most significantly the school bond debt reimbursement, I know you're familiar with. And then finally, they fell on other agencies that local governments really depend on. The state has a unified court system, so anything that impacts the courts impacts local governments and their police departments. Fish and game, a lot of communities depend on active, especially fishing industry, and when fish and game isn't able to do that research, that impacts local governments. And finally, they fell on DOT, and we saw reductions then within either the ferry system or on rural road or airport maintenance. I've mentioned school bond debt reimbursement. This is one of the more significant issues for local governments as it relates to kind of the state-local interaction. This is a commitment by the state to reimburse local governments for their debt payments. The total debt, I think, that's left at about this, I think for this fiscal year, is right around $800 million. And we know that the governor's proposed FY22 budget includes a 50% reduction to that owed for this fiscal year. School bond debt reimbursement was vetoed out of the last budget, 100%, and the year before that, 50%. So just in terms of school bond debt reimbursement, between FY20 and FY22 proposed, it's roughly $200 million that the state has shifted back to local governments who still are making those bond payments, and many have had to either draw down from savings or maintenance budgets, increase taxes, or otherwise adjust their budgets in response to this, these cuts.
Question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So, Mr. Andreasen, make sure I'm saying that right. Andreasen. We learned earlier this week that about $180 million have come to school districts in the form of various CARES Act money. Do you feel that in this during this time, if the legislature did something that raised the cap on fund balances for school districts, I think it's at 10% right now, and if we raised it to, let's say, 25%, they could put some of that money in fund balances and within the spirit of the CARES Act at least hold it over till 2023, which I think was some of the parameters. Would that be helpful, in particular in this instance?
Senator Bonnemoff through the chair. I think so. I don't know that those federal funds can be applied to school bond debt reimbursement, and that would be my kind of caveat around this. It would be helpful to allow those school districts to carry those forward to be applied into future fiscal years consistent with the federal law, for sure. And I think that would give them the flexibility needed to respond to, yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
And I'll just note, I know I included in this slide communities that have both school bond debt and the senior exemption, and the point here is that it really falls on the same group of communities for the most part. So for the school bond debt that doesn't get reimbursed, it's the same group of communities, roughly, that aren't reimbursed for the mandatory senior exemption that hasn't been paid back by the state since 1985. Both are in law as shall be reimbursed.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So when it comes to school bond debt reimbursement, I've listed on slide 10 the total amount that's due to communities over the coming 10 to 15 years. There are a number of communities that have dropped off in their debt since FY20. And I think it's important to look at the school bond debt reimbursement, kind of the bigger picture of when bond payments do drop off and what to expect in these future years. So 8 years from now, only 8 of the 16 will still have bond debt left. In FY26, the total amount of debt to be reimbursed will fall to about half, to about $48 million, as the state's required contribution. And probably Senate Finance isn't the right place to posit hypotheticals, but it does occur to me that the state still may be required to reimburse local governments for the vetoed amounts. While the law does allow the state not to reimburse during that fiscal year based on the appropriation or lack thereof, the debt cut doesn't go away. Local governments pay the debt. The state's obligation is to reimbursing local governments for that payment. And so I would argue that actually those vetoed amounts need to get carried into future years and taken up by the state's debt manager as part of its debt schedule.
Yeah, I think that's subject to appropriation, so I wish them luck. Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask, is AML then going to file suit so we can have our third branch of government make that decision?
AML's looking into legal considerations around the state's obligations when it comes to school bond debt reimbursement. Senator Wilson through the chair.
Yeah. Senator Wilson?
And as a follow-up, then, are you also going to challenge then the required statutes for the senior exemption as well?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, it would make sense that if the state's statutory obligation to school bond debt reimbursement, if it's true that that debt needs to get carried forward, then the same would be true, it seems like, of the senior citizen property tax exemption. And just for your reference, just of the last 10 years, the amount owed by the state to local governments just for senior citizen property tax exemption, about $761 million.
Okay. Well, file litigation if you want. We have, as a policy, been working on trying to get the school bond debt reimbursement paid in full and the REA issue taken care of. And we just have a policy disagreement with the administration, and that's just the way it is. So go ahead and continue to slide 11.
Thank you, Senator. And I'll just point out that we're not faulting how the legislature's approached the school bond debt reimbursement. It's just a matter of tracking debt accurately as we move forward. And I would say that with the moratorium that's in place on school bond debt reimbursement, that there do need to be new solutions for addressing school construction and major maintenance. And while local bonding has allowed the legislature to bypass a GO bond in a statewide vote or corresponding legislation, without this mechanism in place and some portion of it attributed to the state, we are seeing significant reductions to increases to the overall need for school construction and major maintenance. Speaking of bonding, I'll just note that the Alaska Municipal League is extremely concerned about the future of the municipal bond bank. And you'll know that the state lost in its case recently and related to this oil tax credit corporation, the municipal bond bank. Our understanding is uncertain whether it can continue to act in issuance of further bonds on behalf of local governments. And here's a list of how different local governments have utilized the bond bank in its history. And you can see that especially many of our smaller communities really depend on the municipal bond bank for its for being able to carry forward or to address some of their infrastructure needs.
Could you, on this chart, maybe add another column for the committee and put the outstanding balance per capita in your communities? Here you've got total.
Yes, Chair.
Senator Bonimo.
Thank you. I don't understand the link between the Oil Tax Credit Corporation attempt to bond the oil tax credits and the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank. I don't understand why, well, the link, and then why the ruling affects the other.
I think that's more for the Department of Law, and we can get into that, but there's definitely a link and a concern there. It's a whole bigger can of worms that goes beyond just the municipal bond bank, but other bonding opportunities that we thought we may have no longer exists due to the Constitution. The bonds have to be for capital projects.
Okay.
So anyway, we can have a briefing at some point on that. It is an issue. So go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, we have a question from Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Andreasen, what, if anything, have you, as the Municipal League, done to try to get this clarified?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. We joined the state. We filed an amicus brief in support of the state's position, asking for clarification. What the Municipal Bond Bank Authority needs is clarification from the court to say that the ruling as it relates to the Oil Tax Credit Corporation shouldn't extend to existing authorities for especially things like the Municipal Bond Bank. And I guess the Municipal Bond Bank would be better able to answer some of these questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
Another priority of AML members has been community assistance. This has been in place since 1968 in one form or another. You can see, one of the original formulas for how the state funded community revenue sharing, as it was known then, or state revenue sharing. And it was a formula that was attributed to very specifically the different powers that local governments took up. And the services they provided. And we've seen continued erosion of community assistance over time. What that erosion looks like, we've tried to map out here, and sorry my dates aren't done at all on the graph, but basically this is since 1985 when the value of community assistance was just over around $165 million, and we've adjusted for inflation here, but you can see there's a period of time in the early 2000s when community assistance went away. Actually, what occurred in those kind of brief years when community assistance wasn't in place, I think legislative research can point to communities closing their doors, and I can point to sales tax revenues and rates increasing over that time in response to that state action. More recent history when it comes to community assistance, local governments saw a reduction to community assistance negotiated just 5 or 6 years back, a reduction of 50%. And that what we've seen over the last couple of years is when the community assistance fund isn't recapitalized, we see an erosion of the payments. So here's just a short selection of communities and how they've been impacted, what they would receive at $30 million, which is kind of the statutory expectation, and then how that's been adjusted over time without the community assistance fund being capitalized. The big difference is that for larger communities, the formula includes a per capita adjustment, and so all that per capita adjustment is lost, and the base rate, everything goes back down to the base rate. Once we get into kind of less than $20 million a year, we start seeing the base rate eroded as well, and all communities actually seeing pretty significant significant to them reductions.
Great. Next slide.
The Alaska Marine Highway System has been challenged over these last few years. This is an important issue for AML members. The reason we're having this conversation is the graph in the middle, the continued reduction of state investment into the Alaska Marine Highway System. But I want to spend some time just talking about why that's important to local governments. And you can see the list on the left. These are port communities. These are communities that actually have very active economies, and they're good contributors to state priorities. They take on bond debt. They're less reliant on PCE. They're contributing pretty significantly to PERS. The majority of them have police powers, and they contribute very significantly to education. These are the kinds of communities we want in Alaska. And if AML's mission is to strengthen local governments, here's a good way to do it. Provide basic, affordable service, transportation into their communities. And we know that the ferry system does this. And to the argument that, well, there are many communities that are only served by air, yes, that's true. Over 106 or 100 communities are only served by air. And you can see the difference, that actually they're less able to meet the demands of their residents and be the good partners that the state needs. And really the argument that everybody should maybe only be served by air isn't true, and that actually those only served by air need other options to improve their economies and grow their quality of life and see stronger local governments. So I hope that the state can approach it. I know this body has been especially cognizant of the plight at this point of the Alaska Marine Highway System. I'll just finish in my comments related to the ferry system. That during this time when we see the potential for no cruise ship season, we do see a pretty significant option in moving the ferry system in to meet the needs of coastal communities and to meet the demands of out-of-state travelers.
Okay, next slide.
I mentioned power cost equalization earlier in how communities are different. Here's just a quick slide to say that it continues to be a significant part of many local governments' ability to meet the needs of residents. And so here's a short list of communities that do see some of their high costs offset through this program. And we know that their residents especially depend on PCE. So we just encourage, I think the FY22 budget does include continued payment of PCE out, and we would encourage continued support for that.
And that's payment on the first 500 kilowatts?
I believe so, Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it true that we have at least one community that pays $1 a kilowatt? And I think that's Arctic Village. They don't even show up on here, but that for communities that have only paid around 5 cents, that's 20 times the amount of dollars that that community has to pay in comparison to some of the communities that have the least amount.
Mr. Hoffman, I think that's true through the chair.
Okay, next slide.
And maybe I would just add to that that both, I mean, the PCE program and the ferry system bring down the transactional cost of our communities, which means that they have a better ability to see economic development occur. I think that's a priority for local governments.
Senator Stedman.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So, thank you. I see briefly that you're PowerPoint has a little bit of CARES Act and COVID impact slides, but the one thing that I do, I know that the transportation in the state of Alaska, and I think even the ferry itself, did receive some CARES Act money. I don't know if that's going to help offset some of these costs. And then, of course, just going back to slide 12, when you look at police protection as well as hospital services per capita, hospitals per facility, safety and health were one of the highlights of CARES Act money. And I'm hoping eventually in your presentation you will address how some of those have helped to offset the revenue or the, I guess, cost for the community so they don't have to necessarily spend their own dollars, whether it be through sales tax or whether community assistance money, because it's being supplemented by the CARES Act money. So then those dollars are free to spend on other things. You'll touch upon that in a bit?
Senator Von Imhoff, yes.
Thank you.
A quick note on this chart. A lot of these communities on here aren't very well established as a cash economy. So the income, disposable income, and just the income needed to meet the household expenditures sometimes is questionable. In other words, when I've had one of my communities testify and one of the other communities that had hydropower, that the community that he was from with PCE, they had virtually no Christmas lights in their community at Christmas time. And the reason was cost of electricity. They couldn't afford to run them. So that's just a visual difference between the communities. You can go on to 16, please.
Another priority of AML has been the PERS program, the state's pension system. I know that has come up often in this committee. The reason it comes up is the graph. This is from, I think, Department of Revenue or the ARM retirement benefits. And it's the net pension liability. This is a graph of the unfunded liability as it is referred to. We made some inroads into it when the legislature appropriated $2.3 billion additional back just 5 or 6 years ago. But it still remains a significant cost to not just the state but to local governments. I think one of the things that I want to draw your attention to is that we know that the total actuarially determined rate for everything is 30.11%. Percent for this year, but actually within that, the pension benefits portion is 20.89%. The normal cost of that is 2.58%. The past service rate is the big driver of the total rate. It's 18.31%, which is being used to offset that high net pension liability. The healthcare benefits is 3.12%. There is no past service rate, and also the healthcare benefit side is overfunded at this point at 118%. And then also within the 30.11% is the DCR rate of defined contribution rate of 6.10%. And I guess, you know, one of the things that I would argue is that when we're looking at the state's pension system, there are 64 municipal employers as part of it. They make up roughly 18% of the overall pension system. Everybody's hiring DC, defined contribution employees, because that's the plan that's available right now. So we're looking at 29,000 employees who are receiving 6% as a contribution from the state when the budget of local governments for pensions is 22% and the budget of the state is 30%. And I just see a huge opportunity cost when we're talking about the ability for police departments, fire departments, teachers, when it comes to recruitment and retention of our workforce in terms of what we're able to actually utilize on behalf of incoming employees. It remains a significant cost for local governments, but I just think of all the other things they could be doing to incentivize their employees as we move forward.
Next slide.
And how we should look forward, I want to speak just quickly to inflation proofing. I was glad to see the governor's 10-year plan produced by OMB. That's the bottom yellow line that talks about 1.5% being applied to the state budget as we move forward. And I know that for this fiscal year, we have kind of a different starting point based on different fund sources. But I do think it's worth kind of looking at the bigger picture. And the 1.5% isn't applied to the whole state budget, and it shouldn't be. But if it were, you could see a very different trajectory for the state. And it's worth noting that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation and the ARM Board both use higher rates of inflation. And I guess when I look at this, the story that I see is that perhaps when we're thinking about what's coming, we'll see continued reductions to things that aren't accounted for in the 10-year plan's inflation adjustment. And we're not effectively planning for really how much things will cost as we move forward.
Well, the 10-year plan, frankly, isn't worth the paper it's printed on. They can't forecast out that far. And you can take 2000 and forecast to 2010, or 2005 and forecast to 2015, or 2015 and try to shoot to 2025. You'll never get it. Those are just classic examples where you've had, you know, the Great Recession. You've got the COVID issue. There's also in that plan substantial deficits. So this committee's not going to be looking at 10 years. They're going to be looking at 3 to 4 years and trying to turn the ship. So it's an exercise to exercise. And you can't get to the long term if you go broke in the short run, short term. So anyway, we have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
It's just the other thing that we have, and that's the reality, is that 20% of our revenue now comes from oil. About 60 to 70 comes from the permanent fund. Commodity markets and to some degree the equities market are not related to cost of goods sold or inflation. They are at the whims of supply and demand, and they don't care what inflation does. And for us to say that our revenue is going to go up just like that with inflation, nice and pretty straight line, also is just another variable of what you just said. So it's hard to plan because our revenue sources is two.
So don't take my remarks as too disparaging on the 10-year plan. It's in statute. The governor's required to produce it. He did his obligation. He produced it. Don't spend a lot of time with it. If it wasn't in statute, I don't think they'd have done it at all. Okay, next slide, please.
Thank you, Chair. And just when it comes to that inflation adjustment, then, I guess the point is more that there are lots of things that aren't included in state planning, and community assistance, for instance, isn't inflation adjusted. There are lots of formulas that don't take into account inflation adjustment. This is kind of rough numbers on Alaska public education spending adjusted. And to some extent, the state's kept up with inflation, but it hasn't kept up with adjustments in adjusted daily memberships, student counts, and it hasn't adjusted its expenditures according to the increased costs of school districts as it relates to health care or retirement. So I guess what my takeaway is that really schools are being asked to do more with less, and we're looking into kind of what are all the unfunded mandates of schools, what are the expectations of schools, and just as when we're expecting more from schools, I don't see state expenditures really meeting their needs. This body brought up, I think, with the Commissioner of Education last week or something or so, you know, the school bond debt reimbursement and whether the state was following statute and the law on that. It did raise for me a question of where are we at in avoiding litigation, and I don't. I'm not arguing for litigation. It brings enough of a question mark in my mind to want to wrestle with that question. And there are many who would argue that the public education clause found in the state's constitution hasn't been challenged and could be, and it could be successfully. So I guess when we're thinking about where we're headed in these next 10 years or 3 to 4, let's think about how do we adjust appropriately, not just for inflation, but for all the other needs that school districts and communities have. Next slide is related to public safety. This is community and regional jails. You know, essentially, community and regional jails are at almost pre-2002 levels. This is adjusted for inflation. I think for the last 6 years, the state's payment to local governments has been the same. It's been $7 million. It hasn't increased according to need. It hasn't increased according to inflation. Local governments are being asked to do what they've always been doing when it comes to community and regional jails for less and less. And at this point, local governments are providing this state service for about half of you know, roughly 50% of what the twice as much what the state is contributing. So there are many local governments who receive half of their budgets from the state to provide this state service. This is something that we flagged for Department of Public Safety, but I'll encourage you to, when it comes up at the subcommittee level, please do ask that question. Why has it been $7 million for 6 years? And is that the right amount for the service being delivered by communities?
Because we have a structural deficit. We can't make payroll. That's the fundamental answer to most of your questions today. We've got an issue we're trying to deal with before we go insolvent. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Andreasen, the community jails here that you listed, do all these communities also have police powers and have active police forces?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Wilson.
Okay. We're aware of a lot of these issues, and we have to balance them when we do the budget. And we have to make the call on how we're going to make payroll. And clearly, we haven't been able to make payroll with the reoccurring revenue for over half a decade. So,
Chair.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
I think local governments will experience the same thing that the state is when it comes to delivering the state service if it's not funded. And to a large extent, I mean, this presentation is making a case for addressing the revenue shortfall. There are needs. There are services being provided. There's value being delivered by local governments that depend on the state in that partnership. We need a state that's able to address its budget deficit. And here's another example of why. When I look at our infrastructure deficit, I can add up, you know, roughly $21.2 billion in need over the next 5 to 6 years. And there's going to be some crossover amongst this, but I think having it all in one place is gives you a good sense of, you know, where are their needs and how are we deploying resources, not just at the local level, but at the state level to meet those needs. And I don't know that all of these exist in one place at the state level, but I would just share with you that you know, this is a good starting point.
Thanks. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where did you get your information for your broadband number?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, I think that was from an older report. So it might just be an estimate at this point, and I could follow up with communities to see what that number should be.
Thank you. Follow up, that'd be good, because it appears to me that'd be a little light. Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, two questions here. Does AML support the governor's geobond proposals, and how about the use of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's dividend to leverage federal funds?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I think on the general obligation bond package that's been proposed, I mean, I don't know that we support, we can comment on what's in there necessarily. I think we support the idea of the state taking necessary measures to fund infrastructure. A $350 million bond package barely addresses the priority list for school construction and major maintenance for just this fiscal year. It barely addresses the port and harbor needs of just this year. So I mean, it's a step in the right direction is how we've approached it. But we also recognize that the state hasn't necessarily kept all its other debt obligations when it comes to things like school bond debt reimbursement. And I can't comment specifically on the AHFC approach and how the state deploys its resources.
On the harbor needs, the $389 million, are you looking at, is that, what comprises that numeric? Is that new construction or?
Yeah, Chair, I think I've got a slide to talk about Port and Harbor.
Okay, we'll wait for the slide. Okay, any other questions on the slide? Okay, next slide, please.
We already covered school bond debt reimbursement. This is the other program of the state to fund school construction and major maintenance through a grant program that has roughly the same match requirements. I think what's important for us when we look at this is that of the total that's been advanced each year as necessary by communities and schools, 11% of all of these projects have been funded or 16% of the total requested amount has been funded. A large portion of these, I think a lot of these are REAAs, Regional Education Attainment Area School Districts. During the same period, you saw more bond debt being utilized by municipal school districts. So without the school bond debt reimbursement, you actually see an offsetting or shifting in who's applying for this limited resource of the state. Okay. Here's the, I think Department of Education should be completing their school construction and major maintenance report to the legislature here in the next couple of weeks, and so these numbers will be updated then. But this is for FY22, you know, there's over $350 million or so in need identified by school districts. And you can see, you know, that the split between REAAs and municipal school districts. I'll note that if you compare the FY15 maintenance list to the FY22, you can see the shift that I'm talking about, where there's a greater that municipalities are potentially more utilizing this more, and I think the Maybe not more. I think that the, if you look at the list of school districts applying, you'll see a different grouping of requests. So Anchorage, for instance, ends up on the FY22 list when back when there was a school bond debt reimbursement program. You didn't see that same competition between municipalities and REAs. And that's what the outcome of removing the bond debt reimbursement program has been. I think the six-year plan basically points to about $1.3 billion in need, but we know that from the average request, you're probably looking more at like $2.8 billion. 6 years is a lot to plan out for. So it's pretty significant in terms of what's going to be necessary for school construction and major maintenance. And there's nothing in the FY22 budget that we can really see to address this.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Andreessen, I think that maintenance list could be construed as not being totally accurate. You got 16 districts that didn't even apply. And I think there is a fee for them to do the pre-engineering to get on that list. So that maintenance is out there, but it's not truly reflected in that number, is my opinion.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, it's not real. I mean, if you look at how much the state's funded of these programs over its history, I mean, 11% or 16%, there's no incentive for school districts to go through the motions of applying for these projects for state funds. So you kind of have this spillover effect where districts have incredible needs, but they're not applying for the necessary resources.
Almost two decades ago, a decade and a half ago, we funded the entire major maintenance list 1 year, as I recall. The following year, the list was just as big or bigger because schools realized that we were going to, in fact, fund it. And we thought we were taking care of the entire list, which, in fact, we did for 1 year. I think that would go back to maybe 06 or 05, somewhere back in there. So we've been in this predicament before. My comments to my districts is apply for the major maintenance list, because when we prioritize capital spending, we do have a tendency of looking at our obligations and maintenance around the state, and education is one of our fundamental constitutional requirements. So I think it's not advisable to not apply and keep on the major maintenance school list.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just note that one of the major infrastructure responsibilities of local governments is related to transportation. So we know that that many are responsible for roads, both construction and maintenance, roughly 5,500 road miles. I think DOT has a different number that they use for their own road miles, but a federal report pointed to an equal amount at the local and state level. It is a significant portion of local government budgets. And I'll note that municipal roads aren't included within, sometimes within the STIP, within the state planning. When it comes to municipal airports, there's not so many, but they are significant where they occur. Most significant would be that here in Juneau. And while the Ketchikan Airport isn't owned by the borough, it is managed by the borough. And then a number of others have municipal airports.
Okay, next slide.
When it comes to ports and harbors, this is just, I think, a glaring example of where state transportation planning isn't really connected back to that at the local level. The vast majority of Alaska's ports and harbors are owned by cities and boroughs. And DOT only owns 16 of 133 ports and harbors. And I think for a state that has more coastline than the rest of the U.S. combined, it's a huge kind of gap in state planning. And it's true that a lot of these ports and harbors were transferred by DOT to these local governments. They were under maintained. They needed construction, maintenance, updates. And as those transfers occurred, the state made two sets of commitments. The port and harbor matching grants found within AS29-6800. This matches municipal needs. $84 million has been paid out through that program. I think that within this FY22 budget, I think the matching grants program is funded maybe through the GO bond package. But normally should would be part of the rest of the budget. And I don't know, I don't have the history right here of when it's not been funded, but I have a feeling it was subject to some of these last few rounds of either vetoes or budget reductions. MHS terminals are found within the STIP, but no other port and harbor improvement is included in the state planning document. So the port and harbor matching grants are one commitment that the state made back when ports and harbors were transferred to local governments. The others are these, I think the state debt book refers to them as TIDSRA, Transportation Infrastructure. I don't have the acronym right in front of me, and I apologize, but I think you're more familiar with HB 528. These are municipal debt reimbursement projects. Each of these local governments took out bond debt to upgrade their ports and harbors, and the state, during its budget crisis, hasn't been able to reimburse for those, and so you can see also the total debt that's out there for each of these. Again, some of the same local governments that also have school bond debt reimbursement needs, and these are not funded in the FY22 budget.
Okay, let's back up a little bit here to the ports and harbors. You mentioned the matching grant fund and then the statewide transportation improvement plan or whatever. That's a federal, it's using federal money. I don't think that would be advisable to use it in the harbors with all the delays and games that we have to deal with the federal funds. So we have the federal matching grant program, the state grant, harbor matching grant program, where we target $10 million a year, and it's a 50-50 match. The communities that want to participate in that can have 50% of their harbor paid for by the state. They have to have a sinking fund and replacement reserves and run it as an enterprise fund and not come back to us. So the maintenance of those harbors aren't our issue. Our job is to try to get initial construction done. They run them as an enterprise fund and deal with the maintenance and replacement of them. That program's worked very well. And it's unlikely that we would be interested in bringing in federal funds into the harbors to muck it up. That's a successful program. We just have challenges, depending on any given year, with meeting our expenditures and then trying to fund programs like the Harbor Matching Grant Fund. So we'll, unfortunately, some years it won't get funded, and some years it will, but we'll hopefully keep it on the books so when we have the capacity, we'll help coastal communities build our harbors, but not maintain them. That's their obligation.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's not a suggestion to include these in the STIP. It's more that when we're thinking about the role of DOT in planning for Alaska's transportation needs, mm-hmm. I don't know what the other mechanism is for how the state should be thinking about a pretty important portion of its infrastructure that contributes pretty significantly to its economy. So I think that's the only.
Stop there for a minute, just on that point. They don't plan for harbors, DOT. That's the problem. That's why it wasn't funded for years, and we had dilapidated harbors all across the state. Right. And that's why we put in the Harbor Matching Grant Fund, to clean it up. So DOT is not our savior here on this subject.
We agree. I'll just note that in 2010, the Corps of Engineers conducted a survey of Port and Harbor needs. So that's the on the left here, the 2010 planned amount, $1.6 billion. 2010 needed $166 million. We conducted the same exact survey of communities, found still that same planned need. I can't speak to whether a lot of the same from 2010 is carried forward, but the need is doubled. That's where the $389 million came from. Next slide, 25, is municipal water and sewer. I just want to note that you do have two good programs, the State Revolving Loan Fund and the Village Safe Water. They have different roles, and they meet the needs of different types of local governments. But I don't know that it's meeting the full need of communities, which IHS and Health Service maintains a list for just rural communities. That's roughly $1.6 billion. I'm going to switch gears. So that was as comprehensive a list of how state budget decision-making impacts local governments. There are a number of things in the FY22 budget that we're happy to see: the PCE payments, human service community matching grants, village public safety officers, and so on. But I think I've hit on a number of other areas that could see improvements if there were revenue to meet those needs. I will switch gears then to kind of where we're at now in terms of how this public health emergency and economic crisis has impacted local governments. And this is, one way to look at it, and there's going to need to be more work done to really fully understand how COVID-19 has impacted our cities and boroughs. I think it's really important to know that everybody has experienced this differently. There are communities who saw no lost revenue, whose revenues actually stayed flat or even increased during this period. There are communities who saw as much as 90%, 95% of their revenues for a year lost. And then everybody else is somewhere in the middle. There are communities who took on huge increased costs. And where they took on costs, they were mostly compensated out of the CARES Act funding and specifically the coronavirus relief funds that were that came out of the state's allocation from Treasury. And so where they took on additional public health actions or public safety actions, where they worked with their hospitals and schools to meet the needs of residents as it relates specifically to public health, CARES Act funding covered that. CARES Act funding did not cover the lost revenue side of it. And you can see just how different each community experienced this. This is just for roughly two quarters. It's the fourth quarter of FY20 and the first quarter of FY21. We're still gathering the second quarter of FY21, so there's a lag in our ability to say, here's how lost revenue was impacted. But clearly, I think even just from this list, local governments were directly impacted by business closures, by closing public facilities, smaller communities that rely on bingo or utility payments, all saw that revenue extinguished. Any community that was reliant on travel tourism saw a lot of their revenues reduced during this time, and most took measures to address that lost revenue. Some were able to use CARES Act money for some things, but I can talk about that, I think, on the next slide.
Okay, go ahead and go to the next slide.
Maybe the next slide. But for slide 27, this kind of gives you an example of how communities responded. So they implemented furloughs and reduced staff hours. They increased or added new taxes, mostly in response to the school bond debt reimbursement. When that was vetoed, I think I only know of a couple that did that. Many took out, you know, access grant programs, took out loans. They spent down from their emergency reserves. They were able to bring the prior year appropriations forward. They eliminated or reduced program services, waived fees, reduced their capital budgets, eliminated travel and training. So they did all the things that government should be doing during this period to make sure that they weren't, so that new taxes weren't necessary and they didn't overly draw down emergency reserves. And because of those actions, I think it's even more difficult to say here's the impact of COVID, because actually the impact of COVID was for local governments to respond in ways that adjusted their budget to be right during that period. So their losses were less than they might otherwise have been. At the same time, they did do more in response because there weren't statewide orders in place. And so many local governments took on mitigation strategies during this pandemic.
Senator Rulikowski.
Does AML have a position on whether or not the state should, the legislature should pass a law extending the disaster declaration?
Senator Rulikowski, through the chair, we support the extension of the disaster declaration.
Senator Rulikowski.
Can you just talk briefly about the impacts to the to your organization, to the communities in Alaska, if it's not extended?
I mean, if it's not reenacted, I think it wasn't extended. Correct?
Because of the failure of extension.
Senator Rulikowski, through the chair, I think the where we're at is that we depend on the state for a lot of things during emergency response and emergency management. We've lost, local governments have lost a partner to some extent without a disaster declaration in place. All of the things on this slide become even more challenging without a state that's able to respond nimbly to the pandemic. And we're in a good spot maybe right now in terms of emergency management, but we're definitely concerned about when we're not. And what actions local governments will have to do in response.
Okay, next slide.
Fundamentally, CARES Act doesn't make local governments whole. I think it's easy to look at $586 million that went out last year as 45% of the state's allocation from the Coronavirus Relief Fund. That 45% was exactly that amount recommended by Treasury, so you know, we view that amount as the right amount and consistent with federal guidelines. The majority, the vast majority of cities and boroughs have applied for and received their CARES Act funding, so 157 out of 165 cities and boroughs. There are 26 communities that haven't received or haven't requested their CARES Act funds. Only 8 of those are municipal. We hired a CARES Act program coordinator throughout and have been working with communities to see how we can support them. The majority of responses when you see a community who hasn't requested CARES Act funds, they might have been received CARES Act funds separately through their tribal allocation for tribal governments, or they're very small and are concerned about the risk or liability of taking on those funds. There's only 18 million of 568 million that's not been dispersed, or just 3% of all funds. 88% of all funds that went out to communities were expended by the original deadline that was put out there by the U.S. Treasury. This, I could say pretty confidently that this would probably be more like 99% if the deadline hadn't been extended just the week prior. That every local government had in place a plan to account for and report on a full expenditure of their appropriation. So yes, we were just at 88%, but the reality would have been if the deadline hadn't been extended, communities would have reported out a fuller expenditure during that time.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the communities that did not apply, does the law allow for a regional entity to apply on their behalf, such as the Association of Village Council Presidents that comprises some 60 communities? I can understand where small communities may not want the liability, but more often than not, they don't even have the staff to carry out the request or do the paperwork. So is that an issue that you know of, and is that being considered by the congressional delegation in the extension of the Next CARES Act?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, yes, it's allowable. CARES Act or the Treasury guidance allows for transfers between governments of those CARES Act funds. The prime recipient, or in this case, tribes, or in the other case, local governments, would still have to receive the funds, and then they could grant them back up to a regional or at the local government level, a borough government. And that first recipient would still be responsible for the reporting. But you could see many small communities request their funds, receive them, grant them back up to a regional nonprofit, for instance, and have those distributed according to the CARES Act law.
Follow-up then, are you aware of any communities doing this, and is the Municipal League assisting them in getting this accomplished?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I'm not aware of any communities doing that. We've suggested it. We've tried to provide pathways to do so. The CARES Act experience has been, I don't know about traumatic, but it's been challenging for 165 cities and boroughs who have had to put in place, a lot of new processes to accommodate and respond to the federal guidelines. So I think it's been a high level of risk and uncertainty that has delayed any movement toward that. We have maybe an opportunity with the extension of the deadline from 12/30/2020 to this next December 30 to do something different. But I think right now we need to overcome some of the liability or risk concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next slide, please.
Yeah. I just really quickly on this one, I do want to note that fully, and the majority of CARES Act funds received by local governments went out in the form of economic support. And so this $225 million combined with the state's $290 million was a significant investment into Alaska's economy. I've listed here the CARES Act restrictions as it relates to the coronavirus relief funds, there are exceptions to that. So. Public safety will probably come up, public health, public safety, payroll. That is an exemption that's out there, and many local governments were able to apply that, the CARES Act funds, to those budgets, which displaces some of their losses otherwise, which responds to some extent to Senator Bonimoff's question from earlier. Slide 29. Outlines a number of each community submits in its monthly report a list of grants over or expenditures over $25,000. Here's a short list of what those have looked like, and again, you can see just how varied that was. And most of, if you look at the list of kind of higher expenditures, they're either grants out to economic assistance out to businesses, or their significant investments in sanitation, water, sewer, air, and telework type solutions.
Okay, next slide.
A newer development just over the last month or so has been that the Biden administration, President Biden, has announced a 100% reimbursement of eligible expenses by FEMA. And I would encourage this committee and the state to be looking at how it could reallocate what had already been, sourced to their CARES Act or CRF funds to FEMA instead. And we're certainly working with local governments to look at how we could, with the extension of the CARES Act, how we could free up some of the funds that have been accounted for to CRF and might be attributed instead to FEMA with that 100% reimbursement. And it could be that could be as much as $100 million from local governments if they had the capacity to go through the FEMA process. It could be, if you review DHSS's $330 million, some portion of their agency and non-agency support allocations could actually go instead to and be reimbursed by FEMA. And so I would just encourage us all to be looking at how can we really leverage this deadline and this new opportunity provided by an incoming administration.
Go ahead.
There is a next aid package being considered, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, but just really quickly, it is important to both the state and the local governments. The proposal right now is $350 billion, of which the state of Alaska would receive $827 million, or the lowest amount in the nation. Local governments separately receive $258 million under the current proposal. Our argument is that neither is enough, that small population states have been really penalized under this formula, and that if there were a floor established for both states and local governments, we could see greater benefits for both. And I've got a couple of examples of where, especially counties or boroughs in Alaska have been penalized for their small population. So, Denali Borough, who will lose between last year and this year $7 million, receives $409,000 under this current calculation. But this is just something to be watching for, and hopefully this passes through the Senate soon in some formation.
Next slide.
So I've tried, Chair, to make a case for revenue, that there are needs of communities, and when those needs of local governments aren't met, there are knockover effects that impact residents and local economies. We see underfunded priorities and obligations of the state. We see an opportunity for economic recovery and growth, and we see the need to address the state's infrastructure deficit as being good reasons for the state to address its revenue shortfall at this point.
Senator, are you done on the slide? Okay, Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Grizzly, your case for revenue, if I went through your slides and did my math correctly and off of the governor's proposed FY22 budget, our budget would have to be about $31.5 billion to meet all the expected needs that you've laid out. How are we going to... Please explain to the committee or to myself how we are going to make that deficit according to your slides and revenue.
That's from about $4.5 billion up to what number?
Well, I'm adding federal revenue in there too. Okay. But yeah, so if you have the four, we're at.
We better hand the man down the Kleenex here. I don't think we're going to meet the obligation, but if you can help us with the question, please.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I think a big portion of that $30 billion is the infrastructure deficit. And I think the argument is let's put in place the mechanisms to pay that down over time to reduce that deficit. And it doesn't have to be $20 billion right now or $20 billion next year. But what we can't see in our mind is continued underfunding of those infrastructure obligations. And that's what's been occurring because of the revenue shortfall. I think, to some extent, if we're able to look at some of the things that we've highlighted in this presentation and adjust accordingly, even, the underfunded budget of next year, as we're still looking at, needing meeting a $1 billion gap, that's still kind of where we need to get to pretty quickly, would be how AML approaches this, that from this legislature, this year, we need some kind of revenue measure that meets the needs of next year.
Senator Bonimoff.
So one of the questions that I've been sort of posing just to people is, it's not just revenue, sort of think about new cash. So if we get new cash in the form of revenue, whether it be taxes, or oil prices go up, or we cut the budget significantly that frees up cash, or we take money from our savings account, and right now it's basically the earnings reserve account. What should we do with that new cash? So what you're suggesting here is competing priorities. The governor's proposal is any new cash at this point should be paid out as a dividend. You're suggesting that
We either get more cash, so after the dividend is paid out, then we pay this, we layer this on, or we're competing priorities, and rather than paying the full governor's dividend, which is he's proposing, you instead allocate some of the extra cash that we may get from any number of sources to these priorities. What are your thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. AML formed a fiscal policy this last fall because we wrestled with exactly that question. I think where we landed in response to that question is that the state has very clear constitutional obligations. And I think we would agree that it's how do we prioritize those obligations relative to statutory obligations relative to other needs of the state. And I think that's a process that needs to occur in a way to address that question. So right now the constitutional obligations that we see are public education, public health, public welfare, and I would include in public health and welfare the public safety component. So, and those were all things that are underfunded at this point in terms of prioritization.
Follow up?
Yep.
Does AML have a like a one-page letter, you know, legislative priority list that actually has their priorities and dollar figures?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I have a two-page letter, but I will follow up with the committee and provide that and include the numbers.
I wish we had the funds to keep everybody happy and meet all their needs, but it's not ever going to happen. So we've got to prioritize our spending. That's what we do here at the table. So we have other questions on 32 before we go on to 33. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Andreasen, has the League discussed the dividend? And if so, what is their position on the dividend, the amount, and what is proposed in the governor's budget?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, AML has a resolution in support of the legislature finding a solution on the permanent fund dividend. At this point, we've got just as many opinions amongst local governments as we might in this building. I think right now, what local governments, how they've approached it is we need stability. We've passed a resolution in support of a sustainable draw. We passed a resolution in support of kind of sustainability of the permanent fund itself and its future. And that when it comes to the PFD, what Alaskans need are stability and really knowing what they're working with moving forward and an equitable solution applied to all. We haven't taken a direct position on the governor's proposal or on what else might occur.
Okay. Next slide, please.
These last two slides, I think, kind of continue to build off this revenue narrative, and maybe to an earlier question about, you know, how does the state, you know, what's the number that gets the state to meeting some of those needs. This is a comparison of, it's an analysis of tax to GDP and how Alaska compares to other states. So we're the dot on the left, and you can see that local governments, I mean, I would argue, are doing their part. That when it comes to levels of taxation, that puts us right in the middle of where other states are. You know, it's roughly 3.4% of tax to GDP as we, you know, as you go up. When it comes to state tax to GDP, Alaska's is lowest in the nation. And so when you look at tax to GDP, it actually gives you a different kind of measure to know how state taxation relates back to the economy. And you know, international research would point to if you're taxing your GDP appropriately or effectively, you're actually seeing economic growth occur because you're able to meet public education and other infrastructure needs that we've been discussing. One argument would be that there's room here for the state to address its tax to GDP ratio, including considering that tax is applied to one portion of the GDP more than others.
One of the challenges we have with these type of charts is we're the only state that owns a subsurface. So most other states, it's income tax or sales tax or some form of light property tax here and there. So we have to take it with a grain of salt because it's hard to compare Alaska because of that.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So that's a very good point, Senator Stedman. Alaska does own the subsurface. But the other issue is I believe that we're the only state in the union, if I correct me if I'm wrong, that pays a cash dividend to its citizens. And so the question is if we do tax in any form, what kind of cash potential are we taking out of citizens' pockets, whether it be an income tax or a sales tax? What kind of potential is that they would normally spend that money and we're turning it into something else, a cash dividend? And that's, of course, the concept that we're addressing. If the state then didn't pay the dividend, collected that cash and spent it on income producing projects that create more wages, more jobs, that's what the states and these other right-hand dots, right blue dots, are doing. They're creating, they're investing in projects in the preceding 35 pages. So that's the other problem with the big bright red dot.
We have one more slide, and then we have to go listen to the judiciary. We don't have to.
We have
the opportunity to listen to the judiciary so, on the floor. So if we can go on maybe to slide 34, and I think that's your final slide. Is that correct? Yes.
And I'll just close, and thank you through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, for, I think, coming back to how do we recover, how do we do economic development? What are decisions the state can make to look at our GDP in the same way we look at our permanent fund? Both are forms of seed corn that I would argue, and I think local governments would argue, that are worth investing in. And I think what we've described is if you bring down transactional costs, if you make investments, the models elsewhere that actually those pay dividends in the form of GDP growth. And I'm happy to follow up with the committee as you continue to wrestle with prioritization and cash and decisions related to exactly that question, to talk about trade-offs that might be experienced by communities, by residents, and tied back to our overall GDP. And I'll just note that, one of the things that the Alaska Conference of Mayors is talking about right now is prioritizing this GDP growth. If we're on the path to recovery, then let's all be part of that. And putting the economic recovery first right now is maybe a good priority for Alaska's mayors. So with that, thank you.
Okay, we have any other final questions? One just last comment on the slide. I think it might be nice if the Conference of Mayors have a discussion on what things might look like if we eliminate or significantly reduce the earnings reserve account, because that's what we're staring at right now. And if that in fact happens, we'll have to get you two boxes of Kleenex to come in after that one, because we're going to have a heck of a mess. And cost shifts will be unbearable all across the state. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question, but just a comment if I can.
Sure.
Thank you. As I appreciate Mr. Andreasen for coming in and being a member of local government before coming to this body, I do appreciate the presentation today and having him here in person. But if I last recall, Mr. Andreasen is not a member of the legislative body and staff, nor as a state employee. In fact, I believe he's a registered lobbyist. And my concern is if we're letting registered lobbyists in the building before the public, we need to change our policies and open up the building and open up our LIOs so we can allow the public to be involved in the process as well, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, thank you for that comment. We'll take that into advisement as we go forward with our next presentations. I recognize the point being made. We have this building sealed off. So tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., the committee will hear from the Department of Health and Social Services on the governor's executive order to reorganize the department. So with that, we will adjourn today, reconvene at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Thanks. Thanks, everybody, for coming in today. We are adjourned.